Blog Talk Radio.
On the street, seven years old, when he happened to be taken in by an immigrant family, a Lithuanian family, a Jewish family. And they fed and sheltered him and protected him. And thereafter, unbeknownst to the world, he always wore a symbol, a homage to the Star of David. This is the fellow that we know as Louis Armstrong. So I had compelling here. Thinking of Masons as legions in that utopian world of Thomas More, you'd be disappointed. You'll be disappointed with this program today. We're going to be talking about the mindset, the chase to discover the nature and truths of Freemasonry, and how they need to first and last take your own worldview into account in order to answer the questions. There is no one way of practicing Freemasonry, and it's interesting, isn't it, that we have Grand Lodges, the governance, what it is, around the globe, exercising the premise of Masonry, that, and as we can see, that isn't a service club. It's an understanding and savoring the meaning of the deeper meaning of our language, our common language issues, even the notion of charity, for example. Some will think of that as giving a penny to a beggar. Not so with Freemasonry. It's not Freemasonry that's done it. It's the capacity to reason through and to express what it is, what is the moral value, and is there value in doing it? We have people that will believe it's morally wrong, that we're robbing a person of the initiative to stand up for themselves. And on the other hand, surprise, surprise, there's a thought that access to privilege, to a good life, is not there for all. We will say the words, but the reality is it is not there for all. In other words, are the lives that we, the access to the privilege of our different cultures is skewed toward those who already have influence and privilege. Masonry doesn't preach that. It uncovers the way of thinking about it without giving you the conclusion or the ultimatum, step away from the local issues, you know, those things that consume us politically. Those are always local, small issues. To a more grander philosophical level, and where we're really looking at, beginning to look at something that will be consistent wherever we are and whoever we will be with, those truths that prevail through the human species. Now that's lofty, isn't it? And where do we seem to be pushing back on that, or do you or me, do we, what would we say, do we get it? Have we given it? Likely, more likely, have we had a reason to consider it? Coming through the doors of a lodge gives us that reason. If you don't have the mentorship in your lodge, as many will attest, that would help them understand this, the technology has provided us with a way to overcome that barrier. Now we can listen in to the debates and presentations of some of the world's finest minds who happen to be Freemasons. Freemasonry gives us the reason to connect. But their capacity is their own. Freemasonry doesn't do that, unless you would think, if you instill a sense of adventure and learning in me, and I go on to actually do something significant about with that, has Freemasonry changed me? What is the, you know, I guess we're examining the morality of this notion of transformation. Am I to assume that there is this superiority out there that rules, you know, I don't know if we're talking about Huxley's version or Orwell's version, but you have, we're much more inclined to be a bit confused and wanting then to align ourselves. And doing that, when we want to align our thinking, we want to fit into the in-group, and we become political and cliques. We hear those terms, that, particularly, gentlemen, where I am on the planet. And it's not that these men have lost something. It's the nature of living in this vast, vast space. This is a huge, huge country, and when the reality is our history will never ever change. We will deepen and develop as all nations tend, and always be maintaining a proximity to the histories of ancient cultures that gave us our connections with the world and with you. And so it isn't nostalgia, it's understanding that I think draws us to visiting. We're even fortunate now, we can visit these places in our studies. Now we can visit it through the internet during the time when I've been alive. The public has been given access to transportation, so I can fly different places. Better that we had that opportunity, realizing it's coming to an end. Not because of our curiosity diminishing in any way, but the environment isn't able to justify the effects on our climate anymore. Oh, no, there's no anger. It was great while it lasted. And the consequences, well, has there ever been a period in through time when there hasn't been consequence to choices made? We are resilient and tend to go where the fun is. The fun is following the best path out of our history. We take the best and build on it. And if something's niggling away at us, like fascism, let's do that, sort of topical these days, we will examine it. What is going on? Has this always been just, is this something that's in our genetics? Is it something that is, what's the triggering mechanism that causes such levels of fear? Do we need to convulse into these massive displays of heinous behavior in order to have a temporary cleansing? Or today, do we control the levers of industry and banking and make damn sure that nothing like a major military conflict is going to interrupt the flow of our business? Real power. And some historians would remind us that economic gain was in some way responsible for a tremendous amount of conflict around the world and through history. And you and I are a small speck, an insertion in the timeline. You are elevating your thinking, being part of a Masonic lodge. But of course, the consequence, it comes with expectations. How to say, how to think that we have to commit to a particular path out of a sense of loyalty is odd. I think that I would encourage that the loyalty be first and foremost to you. You be loyal to yourself. Know thyself. And then you step off into the questions that form your contribution to the understanding that the rest of us find so fascinating. I'm grateful right now that Masonry has given us this occasion, this reason to meet, to talk, and to share. And what we take from it, well, that's a hope will be entertaining, and hopefully we'll connect with a few ideas with yours. And if we're very fortunate, we'll be injecting new ideas, new ways of thinking. If we can catch our breath and sit back and reflect and perhaps meditate, here's something that on this program we find very helpful. This is Bill Evans at it again. Enjoy. Up with me. I was flipping through my own copy of a Pilgrim's Path. You know, that interesting book, a small book of essays on the chafing between Freemasonry and the religious right. And so I came away from that with this notion of the pilgrim, and thought I'd inject it today into the commentary. See what you think of this this notion, and let me know. Historical records don't seem to capture the adventure of Freemasonry. In this episode, we look into some reasons the order is content to operate out of the limelight. It strains belief to think we are an operation noted for applying philosophical tendencies in real time. It leaves superficialities to others. Who's to say we are a product of our times? We haven't manufactured stories to sway public opinion. It is this conviction to virtue that has withstood the test of time, as if humanity needed to be reminded from time to time. With so much reason to remain underground, is North America preparing to go all in by ignoring the history of Europe and British Freemasonry, as if producing an ISO? If it didn't require the irretrievable levels of moral currency, I am sure it would be seriously considered. Except Masonry formed without a voice or champion. Muted diplomacy spread between men who knew the honor system in a predatory world. To suggest the world has lost a sense of principle is to ignore the appeal of tradition. Some comparisons are fraught. Like when we appear to not account for minority group perspectives and influences. But being a Mason allows us to objectively explore important topics of the day without declaring a political position. Perhaps existential threat is not a political gesture, and cynicism is not as powerful as it would want us to believe. And perhaps we are influencing people without knowing it. As ever, we appreciate intelligence and imagination that has exploded in 21st century world. We treat all peoples like serious thinkers. It would be simplistic to suggest all mankind would be better off following a virtuous life, because given the state of the world, that would be low on the list. However, that doesn't diminish the importance of this thought, virtuous life. More so when you seriously consider the possibilities. And before we launch ourselves into a nostalgic reference of what in the world we're talking about when we mention the term virtue, think about it. And if you need a starter, like most thinkers, there's plenty of good material available just to start the conversation in your head. Do pick a reliable source, Ars Quattro Coronati, Petri Stone, you know, there's others, but be selective because, you know, the internet is often unfiltered. Although we're getting around to that, aren't we? Things we just can't tolerate. Something to think about as we move forward. Michelle Petrucciani is going to help you with that beautiful piece.
He's a composer I love, as well as Duke Ellington. And he wrote a very famous song. Even though it's not really the time to play it, I play it anyway.
Thank you.
can see why the French people loved this performer. Just incredible talent. And he's missed. Need to float along in our thinking back to an influential poet of the day. In hindsight, the world has embraced his work because we've had an opportunity to examine it very, very closely. Talking about John Donne. Some of you may have heard of this fellow. He was born in London, born and died in London. As an infrequent visitor to the city, I can't think of a more magical or interesting place to live life. But the interesting fellow, his history has some interesting trivia. Like he married the niece of Thomas More. Yeah, that Thomas More, the Utopia, thinker, and he studied. Wasn't happy with Oxford, and he attended that for 5 years and left without a degree. There's a story there, but we won't get into it here. And then he was admitted to something called Lincoln's Inn, where he studied law, and there's a lively literary culture around, and he really enjoyed it. But he never worked as a lawyer. Now, it turns out that he did get a position as secretary to Sir Thomas Egerton by the end of 1597. And the interesting part of that is that in that household he met the niece of his boss, a woman by the name of Anne More. Yeah, that's the connection, Thomas More and Anne. In 1601, that's 5 years later, the young couple were in love and married secretly. Oh, can you imagine? A year later, when this came out, and John was fired and thrown in prison. Yeah, they took this seriously. But at the end of the time, he was released, and the couple made off to find their way in the world without the support of the finance and influence of their families. So they relied on friends and sympathetic family members to house them and to support them for many, many years after, even them and their children. But this guy Dunn went on to the next 14 years unsuccessfully seeking public office. And now, whether that was because of this black mark against him, because of what he had done with the niece or not. But this was a fellow who was a Catholic, had been raised Catholic, and Britain at the time was Protestant, and a Protestant king. So not that we would ever suggest that there was bias, but there was. Now eventually, he capitulated and was ordained as a minister in the church or priest in the Church of England in 1615. And he became, not a silly man. He became the royal chaplain to the king. Now, his beloved Anne died shortly after, and this fellow vowed he would never marry again. But his fame as an eloquent and emotional preacher of powerful and learned sermons quickly grew. And he was made the dean of St. Paul's. Yes, that one, 1621. And so in the next decade, he was preaching and writing before falling ill in 1630. He died in March 1631. When he was writing poetry, but when he became a member of the clergy, he began writing these powerful polemic sermons. He was known for it, making clear statements challenging any and all opposition. At the time of his death, his poetry was celebrated and highly sought after by readers. His early work wasn't printed. That was the day when gentlemen would not necessarily feel it was necessary, perhaps beneath their dignity, to actually print and distribute their work to the motley, the hurly-burly around. So his work was passed hand and went around to fans, interested parties, by manuscript, wrote it up. His reputation came and went. Right now, it is what it is. And when he was alive, but it was shortly after, a couple of decades after his death, he had lost the limelight. And by the end of the 17th century, just before we were getting into Grand Lodge kind of thinking, his poems were judged metrically irregular and indecorous. Oh, that's the type of attitude that's just going to bite you, isn't it? When we sit in the comfort of 300 or 400 years of history later, and we can pick out the error in that. You made a mistake. Look what they did with the Impressionists. Same thing. But this is the guy celebrated as one of the leading metaphysical poets of his time. So, sit back. This is, I'm going to show you one of his two stanza of poems. This is Air and Angels. And it's a speaker, and it's stating that he loved the listener before he even knew who she was. Presents a moral question. Unrequited love, is it infidelity? A love in the mind? Not only did he love her, but twice or thrice, two or three times. This love gives an additional credibility. He was sincere in this. The next two lines become some kind of conclusion about the form his love takes. He's relating his emotions to the ways that angels affect us. Love makes itself known through a voice, a shapeless flame. These are ephemeral parts that are impossible to pin down or reproduce. It's likely done with connecting the mysteries of emotion, the power of his speaker's own voice, to the mysteries of angels, ever-changing form. You tell. You see, twice or thrice had I loved thee before I knew thy face or name. So in a voice, so in a shapeless flame, angels affect us oft and worship thee. Still when to where thou wert I came, some lovely glorious nothing I did see. But since my soul, whose child love is, takes limbs of flesh, and else could nothing do but subtle when the parent is, love must not be, but take a body too. And therefore, what thou wert and who I bid love ask it now, that I assume thy body, I allow and fix itself to thy lip and eye and brow. While thus to ballast love I thought, and so more steadily to have gone with wares which would sink admiration, I saw I had love's pinnacle overfraught, every hair for love to work upon is much too much. Some fritter must be sought. For nor is nothing nor in things extreme and scattering bright can love adhere. There is an angel face and wings of air, not pure is it, not pure doth aware. So thy love may be my love's fear, just such desperate as is twixt air and angels pure, twixt women's love and men's can never be. Thank you. Keith Jarrett. Keith Jarrett. We pick up where we left off. We've been talking about the way that philosopher Locke's devotion was being absorbed by revolutionary American Freemasons. They listed him as an ideological trajectory that began with the Druids, went to the ancient Saxons, and ended with the formation of the Grand Lodge in Boston in 1777. Serious-minded, and you know that claim, it's about legitimacy, about validation. Mm-hmm. Make the connection as furthest back in time. However untrue, Locke's supposed membership in the fraternity raised the issue of its allegiance to his political principles, as contemporaries understood. In 1770, John Codrington was preaching in Exeter, and he reminded his brothers that they must never be involved in plots and conspiracies. But he tempers that obligation with the assertion of cherished Masonic ideals. Men of merit, even, he went on, of the most indignant circumstance, we rank as brethren on a level. And Freemasons must free themselves of bigoted notions about religion. Humanity is the soul of all religions. Indeed, the divisions between men are wholly artificial, and Codrington claimed, the whole world is but one great republic, of which every nation is a family and every particular person is a child. To revive and spread abroad those ancient maxims drawn from the nature of man is one of the ends of our establishment. Right, all men in an agreeable humor and enlightening understanding, not only by love of the light arts, but still more by the great principles of virtue. And from such a union, the interest of the fraternity becomes that of all mankind. And yet we note that in the same sermon, Codrington cautioned against admitting women. Not that we do not pay a natural and due regard to the most beauteous part of the creation, but because their presence might insensibly alter the purity of our maxims and our manners. We are afraid that love would enter with them. For Codrington, women represented to men only the emotional and the personal. The lodge is a public place, formal, a space filled by maxims and manners. There is a division in the Masonic mind between the personal and the public, which we shall see reflected even in the mid-century continental lodges intended for women. In the 1770s, Freemasonry in Britain, as on the continent, became increasingly concerned with public issues. At the height of the American Revolution, the Reverend James Smith, lecturing in Kent, proclaimed that by nature, the whole race of mankind, however different they may be in their modes of living, in their size or their complexions, from the most polished courtier down to the savage Kaffir, from the fair Dane to the sooty Negro. However unlike these are to each other, however unknown, still, they are brethren. As all men are by nature brethren, so consequentially all men are by nature equal. This man of democratic sentiment, who we met earlier through his use of Newtonian imagery in his sermons, Newtonian imagery is suggesting that the premise that things are static and not interactive has been replaced by an understanding of dynamics between. He speaks not only of the force of attraction binding the universe and the need for order and harmony, but also in the equality of all men, attempting somewhat frantically to hold those notions to an increasingly fragile equilibrium. As he says, a good Mason is properly said to live upon the level with all men. Yet Freemasons are by no means levelers. Order and subordination are requisite for the welfare of every society. Spoken but a few years before the outbreak of the first wave of democratic revolutions on the continent, this sort of Masonic rhetoric, which offered the private lodge as the cosmopolitan ideal of society as a whole, simply restated boldly what had always been in the heart of the Masonic utopia. In tandem with the proclamation of luxury and affluence, so as ideals, came the almost naive belief that the meritorious actually deserved to prosper. To say so simply and so straightforwardly as Codrington did in 1770, that we are all upon a level and merit is the only just distinction, may well have encouraged those who regarded themselves as meritorious and who resented the distinctions and prejudices that inhibited their progress. Such utopian sentiments could justify demands for concrete social reforms, for the transition that private Masonic ideal into public action, the abolition of privilege and corruption, the institution of true fraternity and equality for all men, even for all women and also for slaves. The Masonic presence in these revolutions, however moderate and undoubtedly unspiratorial it might have been, must be understood by reference to this utopian rhetoric, and hence in relation to the legacy of the English Revolution in all of its phases. We're looking here at the utopia as something that we would seek out if we were given the choice. Just take a look at Moore's work, A Utopia, and you see that there are consequences that would be a challenge for free thinkers. The struggle between the freedom of thought and morality, of the emotional state of decision making, and the moral calculation that leads us on a more purposeful and constructive path. We can only wonder how this has morphed, how this has moved through time to where we are, where we sit today. Relevance, well, I would think in general, but in terms of specificity, are we a more moral society today than we were then? I think we want it. I think humanity is still in that process of coming together, and we have new reason to be optimistic. If there's a group like Masonry, I'll put this to you in closing here. Does a group like Masonry change the probability of possibilities? Do we, and when we look around, and the truth of our existences as a society of applied philosophy is known not by what we say, but by what we do. And when you look around in our understated fashion, are we an influence for that global community? A community where the argument isn't a declarative that everything is equal at this moment, but as a point to which we strive that all people, whether the despot in the far and distant land or the politics trying to manage the status quo. It's put out there this sense of equality, fairness, justice. How influential. And as a dear man often reminds me, he is able to influence the person next to him and doesn't expect much further than that. And I think that idea has some texture. That's history. Sitting in with us today. It's been a pleasure. It's been very, very much a pleasure. Odd that we are, not so odd. It's a privilege to be with men of your thinking. Freemasonry has existed because it matters to us. Not necessarily to the whole world. Oh, it's a real measure of conviction to have that Renaissance thought that is there a real benefit to putting our thoughts in print and then distributing them? Really? Sort of puts an end to efforts to treat us like business. There's so much more. It's like suggesting that art galleries, the La Scala is a business. Really? That's the first thing that comes to mind. That all hospitals are businesses, that the universities are businesses. I tend to think business is conducted through them. But masonry, so, so much more. If it matters to a handful of us, we know we can form a lodge. And my goodness, you and I will know who those masons are that would sit and dedicate themselves and know how to keep their own counsel without drawing attention. Internally, we struggle with that. So, here, I think to encourage you to be that influence, there's no need. But I draw back on this more than once, thinking that if I follow the logic of this kind of reasoning, I would never have considered an appended group. None of them. Because I would have been focused on understanding and being content with what I had, the 3 degrees of a Master Mason. Now, as I as I reflect on that, I find there is an honesty to it. You have everything that you need. Now, understanding that, or hearing it is one thing, understanding it, that takes a bit of knocking around. It's a notion that I subscribe to. Then what do I make of these other apparitions? I wouldn't fault anybody for being part of an organization that just fundraises to support hospitals. No. And is it Masonic? Well, you know, it is. If you were to say to me, were the ancient kings of Egypt Masons, you know that how loosely you have to weave history and how much conjecture is involved to make that argument. So is all of this fit within under the umbrella of Freemasonry? Well, let's hope so, if it's positive. But let's hope that Masonry has been the catalyst, has been the influence that sparked that. And then let's hope that one day they can stand on their own. But they don't have to. They can always be reliant on Masonry being the spark, being the source of inspiration. So I hope you've enjoyed the program today and that you will think kindly of it when you go about your business this week. I look forward to being with you where I am in Australia. Hello, I hope the winter is going well for you. In Spain, the fires stopped, I hope, I only hope. And the flooding in Germany has passed. To our listeners there in Denmark, I hope that the climate is beginning to become a little more predictable. And in Greece and in Croatia, where our listeners are, I'm sorry to hear about the way the climate is treating you there. I really am. I reach the extension of our reach of this program to Peru and Argentina is, I think, simply an acknowledgement that we exist. This similar mindset about Masonry exists around the world. And with that, Masonry will continue for a long, long, long time to come. I'll leave you there and hope to see you again real soon, if we could ever sit and enjoy time in Lodge together. That would be sublime. Now, you listeners in Oman, what in the world? It's a pleasure that you're able to connect with us here. No, North America is not the center of the universe. I'm here in the Great White North, struggling and carrying on just like you. So we'll do this again, I hope. See you. Thank you. Mm-hmm.